Begin.
Please note that the following program includes adult themes and language. You're listening to the weekly show on Discourse.
Yeah, I'm back.
We're all back. I'm Morgan Nickel, big mouth dickhead from the internet.
And I'm Dylan Reeve, 100% loving it pure.
I have a feeling that you are doing a lot better this week than last week.
I am doing at least 97% better.
Did appreciate you answering my call, though, but you didn't have
very
a lot
briefly, to say.
Very briefly,
yeah.
And I apologise to anyone who listened to the last few seconds of last week's show, because...
Or the first 30-odd minutes.
Hey now, Jordan Carter was really good. Unfortunately, I was also there.
These things happen.
It's always a problem. So what are we going to talk about? There's all sorts of things we can talk about this week. I had a really excellently exciting guest lined up, and he was keen to come on, and he is all over the news. Unfortunately, that means he's busy, and you've got to get in line. I'm not going to tell you who
Hobbit?
It was. It was good grief. No, I cannot think of many things that would that I would like less, actually, than having a Hobbit on, or any of them. Not about the Hobbit, anyway. Maybe some of them would be nice to have on as people, and perhaps we could do our very best to avoid mentioning it. I feel like New Zealand has lost its shit over this goddamn movie, and Wellington is offender number one. It is so tacky.
They did it for Rings too, didn't they? I mean, is it worse than Rings was?
I feel like it is worse than Rings was.
I'm surprised that 3 News deemed it necessary to do 2 hours of live coverage from essentially the red carpet outside. Anyway.
Yeah. If you've seen what TVN's, I haven't been watching today. When is it happening? Today? Tomorrow? Yesterday? The day before?
It's happening yesterday or tomorrow.
Right, okay. So yesterday, TVNZ's schedule was ridiculous, crossing all day. I mean, I've been seeing ads about what they're going to be doing, and it makes no sense. It's not a New Zealand story. It's not actually ours.
No, I mean...
It's European. It's not New Zealand. And you know, it's just being made here. Okay, so... It's really great for our economy for it to be made here, and it's really cool for our film industry. And yay, Peter Jackson, he's the man of the people. Obviously, he's completely not the man of the people with his private jet and his knighthood and his...
You don't have a private jet or a knighthood?
No, not yet.
Oh.
Not yet. Now, I've got to go and take credit for other people's work a bit more, I think, to get a knighthood. And I'm sure the private jet probably is a bit easier to achieve.
Yeah, the private jet's just money.
Overrated, that guy.
I don't know.
Sir Peter.
Yeah.
That's Sir Peter. Anyway.
I don't think necessarily that he is, but he's a very strange relationship he has with, well, everyone. Very strange relationship New Zealand has with him.
Now, let me see. Can I find... I want to find... Yes, Nickel Williamson. This is going to be a real moment for a lot of people who experienced The Hobbit in the same way that I did as little children. Oh, I need part... This is part one. Is this the right one? Anyway, we'll see. Is it going to work? Please work.
I'll just sit here.
I want you to just sit there. I want everyone just to do nothing and just pay attention to what's happening. Where's my thing? Where's my thing? Why is it not?
Do you want to call tech support?
They've been calling all day. I was on the line all day because apparently Microsoft tech support from India, they detected a problem with my computer. And,
And your registry.
And so I gave them the key that they apparently needed, and then I just, you know, watched them while they moved their mouse around, and, you know, I just put my credit card into the thing where I was told to, and away it all went. It was actually really good. There we go. This will bring back moments, I think, for a lot of people.
In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. Not a dirty, wet hole, nor a dry, bare, sandy hole. It was a hobbit hole, and that means comfort. His name was Baggins. The Bagginses had lived in the neighbourhood of the hill from...
Anyway, so that is and will always remain the ultimate Hobbit for me. And, I mean, obviously I'm going to go and see these goddamn movies. It doesn't make any sense to me that there are three of them.
Yeah, that's interesting. The cynic says they're just cashing in, but maybe not. Maybe they felt that they needed to, I don't know. It's hard not to have the cynic voice when it comes to Hollywood movies.
Yeah.
They are not doing themselves any favours.
I loved The Hobbit so much when I was little. I actually didn't read Lord of the Rings until I was... I think it was just after or just before the first Lord of the Rings film came out. So that wasn't my book. Hobbit was my thing, and it wasn't a book for me. It was a record. You know, one of those plastic discs that spun around and had a thing detecting grooves on it. That, you know, very young listeners will not be familiar with.
No, no idea.
Anyway. So Wellington, tacky. I understand that it's a popular thing.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what the figures were, but apparently the first ones made us billions in tourism. And that's cool. But it also, along with that, is this perception that New Zealand is Middle Earth. And we've got all the Hobbit, you know, the Hobbit, the Shire tours. And our advertising refers to us as Middle Earth. And we're not Middle Earth. We're fucking New Zealand. And that's better. Because it's actually real.
Well, for what it's worth, I think the advertising only does that around this time.
Yeah, well, hopefully.
It reverts back to its potentially flawed slogan after this.
Well, I mean, I hope that you're right. I mean, of course, it's gonna shift and change over time.
But
we have our own culture, right? Tolkien wasn't a New Zealander. So it wasn't even authored by a New Zealander. As far as I know, he never visited. No aspect of it is set here. You know, it's not us.
But it does gather global interest, and it gets people here, or it gets people more interested in New Zealand. I've certainly spoken to a number of people who became more interested in New Zealand after the Lord of the Rings movies, and then learned more about New Zealand, which is stuff that you can't. You know, it'd be very hard for us to export that as it is wholesale.
Yeah.
It's good to find an entry point. That's what these movies have done in the past.
I mean, of course I buy that. Of course I agree with that. And I do like tourism a great deal. It makes me cringe. You know, there used to be the old cultural cringe thing that New Zealanders apparently did when they heard our accent, you know, and people would talk about the tall poppy thing. I hope I'm not engaging in any aspect of that. I dislike people who call New Zealand Middle Earth, you know, and I see on blogs.
I don't think that happens very much. I think it is just around this time we don't all, but the tourism industry gets very excited. Air New Zealand changes their logo on Twitter. They paint up a plane specially. There's some stickers stuck on a baggage carousel at Wellington Airport. There's a big golem stuck in the airport. I think that's all very exciting, and it's cashing in on the, you know, on the hype and the buzz. And then it all goes away, and the ongoing stuff continues to trickle in. But the New Zealand that is available for people then is still mostly New Zealand with a place you can visit that has holes in the hill. That's it.
Except that we actually never stopped embracing it at any point between the first trilogy and the beginning of this trilogy, did we?
I don't think it continued to be an ongoing marketing.
I think it was.
Well, maybe. I don't think that's the case. I don't think there was a lot. I don't think much of our international marketing effort was around Lord of the Rings after, you know, substantially after Lord of the Rings.
Well, it was the perception.
Well, maybe. But anyway, I don't think, you know, you don't, once the Hobbit's finished, the golem will disappear, the plane will be painted back to normal, whatever the hell the New Zealand paints their planes as these days, and the baggage carousel will be beige again.
It sure is a good thing that that Peter Jackson and John Key smashed the unions and so on, or otherwise those films wouldn't have even been made here, apparently.
That's a very complex thing, and
I think it was a negotiation strategy for Warner Brothers to get more of a kickback. I think it was always going to happen here.
Well, that may have been part of it. I do think it was entirely possible, at least, that the shooting wouldn't happen here. I think the post probably always would have, because Weta's, you know, it's obviously Peter Jackson would have come here to edit it, and Weta's here, and the the close relationship that he can build with, you know, the physical closeness between Weta and the, you know, the edit suites and Park Road Post and 3'6" or whatever they're called these days, is very practical. I don't think that would have changed, but I think certainly if they'd felt that it was an unstable environment to shoot here,
But a lot of shooting would still have happened here in the sound stages. That still would have happened here.
Well, maybe. That could have happened anywhere else, though. I mean, there was nothing tying it here, you know?
Except that if we were doing the post here, wouldn't it make sense to shoot all of that green screen stuff and so on here?
Not necessarily. Maybe. I don't think so.
If all the props are being built here, which obviously Peter Jackson would have done, you know, if all of the CG is being done here, if all of the editing is happening here, then, I mean, I think the prospect of taking the actors off to, you know, wherever.
Well, it's not taking them off to anywhere, because wherever they, you know, the vast majority of them came from outside of here anyway, so it was just taking them. In fact, a lot of them are from the UK, so if they'd chosen to shoot it in the UK, they would have had to travel them less distance. The main unit shooting happens, you know, separately to the editing. There's no reason they couldn't have shot pretty much anywhere in the world. I mean, a lot of films shoot, you know, shoot somewhere in the world and then get edited in Hollywood.
Yeah. But so I guess
there's
the
no
thing
reason
is
to assume that they wouldn't do that.
But if Weta Digital were doing all of the work that they obviously were going to do on it, then, I mean, that means that some of the shooting would be happening here, surely.
Again, not necessarily. You know, Weta Digital do a lot of work for other productions that get shot elsewhere.
And doesn't that usually require bringing some of the actors here?
No, not often. It doesn't.
It depends
often
on what the shot is. It depends on what the shot is, obviously.
Yeah, but often they do a lot of that stuff. You know, that stuff's all... it's all just footage and telemetry data. It can be done in any appropriately equipped studio in the world.
But Weta has all of that stuff here.
Oh, so do a lot of other studios.
Yeah, but
and they can
pack Peter Jackson's own production company is based here. Obviously,
Look,
he was going to make
it
here.
I'm not saying that wouldn't happen, but you know, to say that it couldn't have gone overseas is ridiculous.
Well, making the point that, anything is possible.
When the money all comes from a studio and the studio essentially gets to call the shots, if the studio says, we don't like it there, for whatever reason, not enough tax breaks, unstable working environment, whatever it be, then the studio calls the shots. The studio says, fuck it, we go to England or somewhere else.
I don't think there was ever any prospect of that.
I think it's silly to suggest there wasn't, frankly. There's nothing tying it to New Zealand particularly. Anyway, happened.
Yeah, it happened, I think it was always going to happen. And I think it was they wanted more money and they got it, but they actually, it was just brinksmanship, and there was never any prospect of it going anywhere else. The only people that ever seriously spoke about it going anywhere else was the UK Film Commission, who were agitating for it to happen because, of course, they had a financial interest in that, and Warner Brothers when they were negotiating to get kickbacks. And, of course, since then, Key has gone and visited them in Hollywood, and the .com thing's gone down at, you know, the request, at the direction of these Hollywood studios.
Well, the .com thing has nothing to do with New Zealand government particularly.
Oh, really?
It's all about the FBI.
You reckon, wasn't approved? The FBI doesn't get to come and operate in New Zealand without pretty high-level approval.
Well, yeah, they do.
No, that's rubbish.
No, well, they do.
They don't, though. They're actually not a New Zealand organisation.
Will you let me finish? If the FBI in the States,
the CIA might,
can drum up a reasonable enough case, which apparently they were able to, then they can request extradition. That's what happened. They didn't need New Zealand's involvement at that point.
They were FBI.
And then once
you don't
New
think
Zealand
that was approved?
Involved,
you don't think that was approved?
I don't think New Zealand was involved at any point until, essentially, they came here and started doing their investigations for extradition here. I don't think the case hinged upon New Zealand approval up until the extradition got involved.
I think that
the FBI and Department of Justice were quite capable of carrying out their own investigation of the States, regardless of what New Zealand did, or whether or not The Hobbit was shot here.
I think you're
or
drawing
whether Warner
outside
Brothers
the lines
with
a bit.
John Key.
Yeah, I think the crayon's gone outside the lines a little bit. Everything is possible, of course, Dylan. Everything is possible.
But there's
plausibility. And then there is, this
very,
is possible.
Some, you're drawing some very conspiratorial lines here.
Some conspiracies are real.
Yeah, I don't think those ones are. I think, of course, you know, John Key, as his role is he Minister of Tourism as well?
Yep.
then meeting up with the Warner Brothers people is not unexpected.
Yeah, actually, the next story is
could I?
Is a conspiracy. This is something I'm going to be very careful talking about.
All right.
In the now, never mind the stuff that Garner was doing and Patrick Gower were doing on TV3, on the website mainly. They posted various blogs about how Cunliffe, his career was already basically over, and he was obviously gunning for the leadership position. And they said they had an insider, right? And they would never name them. And it was Mallard. Or maybe it was Annette King. Maybe it was Gough. But there's this tight group of old hand Labourites who are in the David Shearer camp. And so they started a whispering campaign and they started feeding stories out to the media. Okay, and now obviously, and this is something I didn't talk about much last week, the David Cunliffe thing, because...
it was uncomfortable for Jordan to talk about it.
That's right. And he did not ask me not to talk about it. I said that I wouldn't.
Yeah, while he was clearly on. Would put him in an awkward position.
It would put him in an extremely awkward position because he is probably going to be, he is hoping to be a list candidate at the next election and at a higher level than the previous time. Because he's really good. He's really clever. He's a sharp dude.
Yeah.
And so, of course, I didn't want to cause any trouble for him with that. Because I want to see him in Parliament. He's a good dude. And the people at the top of the Labour Party right now, I don't think they are very good dudes. And since the whole Cunliffe thing went down, we've seen an article by Jane Clifton in The Listener about this whole thing, about the plotting and about his failure, about his disloyalty and about how, you know, there was never a chance that he was going to manage it because he's, you know, an arrogant so-and-so or whatever. And it's got that big smug smile thing at the top of the article, and away you go. Now, here's the thing. Jane Clifton's boyfriend is Trevor Mallard.
Wow.
And you don't see anything about that on the article, do you?
I'm surprised she'd even write about it, to be honest.
She should have stayed the fuck away from it.
Yeah. You know, I just paid so little attention to the Labour leadership coup thing. I just didn't give a shit, and I still, I'm sad to say, don't really.
I think that anyone who wants to see a left or a left-leaning government at the next election has to support whoever the leader is. I think my feeling is that Cunliffe would be better at it because he is so fucking powerful. I mean, he's got a real grasp of the facts, of the numbers. And we saw that in the Labour leadership when they were actually battling it out, when Shearer won. Shearer basically had no idea about anything, and Cunliffe had everything just at his fingertips. He's great in the House. He's a powerful debater, and he's a pretty good speaker, except when he's denying that he's about to make a run at the leadership. He played the political doublespeak thing that made it clear that he was thinking about it, and it was just pointless. There was no reason for him to do it at all. And as Raj in the chat room has just said, Cunliffe comes across as quite slimy at times. And, you know, I don't know about slimy, maybe smarmy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if slimy is right.
Maybe I'm not paying enough attention, but neither of them grabbed me particularly. I find Shearer just completely uninspiring.
Yeah.
And wishy-washy, maybe. I don't know if that's the right word. I don't really know enough about him. The only times I see him are these occasional things about the leadership coup, and then he does come across, yeah, smarmy, perhaps, or scheming, maybe. I don't know. He doesn't come across particularly great either. But I kind of would like to see Labour, you know, return to power, or at least do a lot better in the next election.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I just couldn't give many shits about the internal politics of it. I understand that it makes a lot of difference when it comes to the election, but I'm not a member of the Labour Party. I can't vote on it. I don't really care about it. I have no say in it, and I just can't be bothered devoting any attention to it, really.
But here's the thing, and this was the point I was very slowly building up towards.
Very.
As uninspiring as Shearer is, and even though I prefer Cunliffe, I want to see a left government formed, a left coalition government formed after the next election. And that requires supporting whoever the leader is of each of the realistic left parties, including Shearer. And I very clearly wasn't doing that. Now, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in February, because I feel like Cunliffe is probably cursed now. I think that his support has possibly now irrevocably evaporated, just because the people who were in his camp are now so afraid of being kicked to the curb, because Cunliffe is probably going to come back into the fold because he is so obviously talented. But if you looked down the list of people who had confirmed that they were his supporters, they're not actually inspiring. But I think part of the reason they're not inspiring is that we haven't really heard of them, because most of them are newer. And the reason that we think of the others as kind of maybe slightly better performers is just because they've been around for so long. All of those people like Goffin and Annette King and actually not Shearer, he's new in the job, but all the rest of them, they've been there since like the 1980s. They've been there for too long.
I'd really like to see a lot of politicians, or at least the leadership of politicians, I'd like to see a new breed come through. I'd like to see more young. I'm
like Jacinda
much more inspired
Ardern
by people like Jacinda Ardern and Gareth Hughes say.
Yeah.
I'm much more convinced that they are, I mean, if nothing else, they're more connected to people. They're talking and listening more.
In the House for, 30 years.
Yeah, look, there's a value in people who understand. Apparently, Jacinda Ardern is a drinking word. Every time we say Jacinda Ardern, you have to have a drink.
Oh,
That's two more drinks, Jerry, Matt. That little just explanation of it there, by the way.
She's so good.
I mean, there's value in having people who understand the parliamentary process. You know, some of the veterans contribute a lot in that way, I'm sure. But yeah. I would just like to see, if not the younger members in a leadership position or something like that, then at least in some sort of way where they're clearly being listened to, influencing what goes on. I think Gareth certainly has more senior position in the Green Party than someone like Jacinda Ardern has in Labour, for example. Labour seems to be run very much still by the old school, the old boys' club, boys and girls.
One of the possible... I'll let you finish your thought in a moment. One of the possible outcomes that I've seen mooted for a possible Labour leadership battle in February is Grant Robertson as the leader with Jacinda Ardern as the deputy leader. And apparently it's not entirely unrealistic.
I could get behind that.
Grant Robertson is another person that's like, wow, I'm so excited about that. So what's he done? They have a real uphill battle. Because, I mean, honestly, I prefer most of the left's policies generally, because they don't seem to want to sell everything, which does make a big difference.
Though, it can get, like, the house building thing, which I listened to Jordan talk about it. I mean, he didn't have a lot of the details when he talked about it last week, but what seems to be lacking there is, and it's so often I found with Labour's policies last year, was they come up with the big ideas but are very lacking on detail about how they could possibly be executed. And, you know, when you just look at them on the face of it, you're like, well, that's a nice plan, but I just don't think it's possible.
And in fact, it's...
And you need to convince me.
Sometimes it's more like, that's a nice outline, but have you got an actual plan?
Yeah.
But the same is definitely true, and even more so if National, where, you know, they will criticise Labour when they give any detail of any policies. But, you know, they've been in for 5 years now, and their ideas don't seem to be great. You know, they don't seem to actually be doing a great job. What they've managed to achieve is to, in some respects, actually make us a bit of a laughingstock. And I suppose this takes us on to the next story, which is this thing with Massey University water ecology Dr. Mike Joy.
God, it's such a big rat hole. This
we've spoken about this a bunch of times, and I mean, sure people are sick of hearing me talk about it.
Well, there's lots of cows.
Yeah,
they shit all over the ground.
It's actually
the water runs into the rivers.
That's actually not the whole problem. Now that is part
they piss on the ground.
And that's part of the problem as well. But another problem is that to grow the grass that they need to eat in all of the areas where they are now being farmed,
fertilizer on the ground,
and to grow the density of beast on land, which actually would support only a small number naturally, we fertilize the hell out of the ground. And so, of course, some of that is soaked up, but much of it runs off into waterways. And, you know, of course, there's also...
And it fertilizes algal blooms and...
Precisely.
...sucks up water chemistry.
And sometimes when cattle have direct access to waterways, they all poo in it and they smash up the riverbed with, you know, clomping around. Because they're big animals, they drink a lot, and that's good, they need that. But the thing is that there actually are some relatively easy solutions to some of it. And one of them is having setbacks from waterways. So you fence along a creek or a stream or a river, and you just keep the cows further away. As well as that, you know, there's certain, you know, sort of bioscience stuff in terms of taking care of the grass. It doesn't necessarily require a lot of fertilizer. You know, crop rotation doesn't require a great deal of fertilizer. It's about, you know, complementary planting and planting things in the right order. And you can do a similar thing with care when you're just growing grass.
Yeah.
It's just another plant. And the using a lot of fertilizer, it sort of has an environmental double whammy, because it comes from somewhere. A lot of it is made as a petrochemical industry product, and some of it is dug up out of the ground and is actually, you know, it's a finite, although maybe currently there's a lot of it, it's a finite resource.
So the thing that frustrates me about this debate, or not about this debate, about this issue, is that it's so easily derailed, right? So because this has come up because of an article in the New York Times criticizing our 100% pure tagline, quoting Mike Joy. So then the argument gets directed towards the people criticizing the tagline, which is sort of not the issue.
Yeah,
we can all agree that 100% pure is maybe it's a good marketing slogan.
Yeah.
The problem we have is that we're not living up to it, and I think most of us don't want the marketing slogan changed. We'd like to do better at living up to it.
That's right.
We don't want to have less tourism,
yeah.
But, you know, internationally people are starting to realize that our slogan doesn't actually live up to our reality, and perhaps we should look at that and accept it. But instead of doing that, we just engage in ridiculous debates about the slogan. It's almost like the issue was presented with a built-in sidetracking part.
Yeah.
To sidetrack us and give everyone involved a great way to avoid discussing the actual issues.
Yeah.
It's just annoying.
Yeah.
And I wish we could be, you know, this is the thing that bothers me about politics, and both sides do it, and it's that they won't, they get too tied up in point scoring.
Yeah.
And therefore avoid having reasonable and rational discussions about actual issues.
Yeah, the linguistic games seem to take over.
Yeah, you get into these little games and little sidestepping and the ha-ha this and ha-ha that and, you know, making references to McDonald's, and it's stupid.
Yeah.
Actually talk about the issues, you know. I would be 100,000,000% more supportive of any political party if they could actually approach things honestly. If, you know, John Key could get up and say, you know, the article was unreasonable, and you know, we think the slogan's fair, but indeed there are some issues, you know, that we need to look at better, and we haven't been doing a very good job of it, and, you know, it's something we're aware of.
But Dylan, you're forgetting that Jerry Brownlee's really fat.
Of course, Jerry Brownlee is fat.
Now, one of the things that I thought was...
He eats a lot of cows, so maybe we should just put him nearer the waterways.
You know what? I mean, I do too. I've criticized him for that, because he is horrific. But that is not the problem with that guy. I mean, if he was a reasonable person and not a cowboy in Canterbury who had, you know, done his job to destroy democracy there, then people might not care so much about the fatness. Now, one of the most shocking things that came out of that New York Times article was a link to PLOS1 research article. And so, I mean, you talk about how New Zealanders just want, you know, we don't really care about the branding, the 100% pure branding. What we want actually is not to change that, but to fix our rivers, right? And one of the things that they rated and compared New Zealand on against 189 countries was our commitment to decreasing our environmental impact. And that was what we did, the absolute worst that we did out of everything. We were 18th worst in the world.
Yeah, no, I mean, no question. It's not us as a people, it's us as a government we elect. And unfortunately, our government is very farmy, you know, for better or worse.
They're very anything for a dollar. And New Zealand has to be farmy.
Well, it does. It's certainly in the immediate term. We can't just get rid of all the cows.
We can't just turn it off.
Maybe we can look at, you know, actually take a better look at reducing it and not just make the primary industries the primary industries.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I hope you've enjoyed the Discourse Politics show.
At farming. And actually, you know, my family's done pretty well out of farming. You know, my family owns a lot of dairy farms, actually, as it happens, in the Wairarapa. But that's an area where, actually, I think for the most part it makes sense to have dairy farming because there is enough rainfall to have decent grass growth.
And it's pretty flat.
Oh, I don't know if I'd necessarily say that.
Some parts of it. All right.
Yeah, some parts of it. Not compared to Canterbury. No, definitely not. Anyway, so there's that. And actually, I've been emailing back and forth a little bit with Mike Joy about coming on the show, and he was very keen, but there was just no time. There's just no time for him to be able to do it.
Shockingly, he's somewhat in demand to talk to people about stuff at the moment.
But hopefully we'll be able to get him on. He suggested recording during the day, and maybe I should have, but I find it awkward to record and then play it back into the show because, Dylan, you'll just kind of sit there twiddling your thumbs. It'll be stuff I've heard, and then...
I do a lot of that anyway.
Then we'd be meant to comment on it afterwards, and neither of us would have been listening, probably. So
yeah, it's probably.
I find that for guests, we kind of have to have them live or sort of not have them at all, and that's why, you know, almost every week we talk to someone about coming on. It's just, you know, we usually only give them about 4 hours warning. So, you know, as keen as people are, it doesn't always work. Anyway, how about you do a story? How about that for an idea?
Okay. Oh, where shall I begin? We'll start with something light. Yeah. I know that a particular developer friend of ours is in the chat room at the moment, so I'll bring up this one. Oprah. You remember Oprah?
Yep.
She's fat, and then she's not, and then she is again. I don't know where she's at the moment. Yeah. She tweeted recently about her love for the Microsoft Surface tablet. She said it was one of her favorite things.
Oh, that's interesting. I bet she. What she liked about it, I'm sure, was typing on that little keyboard. And I bet that's why. I mean, I bet her tweet that she sent because of that keyboard had no typos in it, and no weird Apple-y word spelling correction or anything like that.
Yeah, no, she's don't think so. She said, "Gotta say, love that Surface. I've bought 12 already for Christmas gifts. Favorite things. Twitter sent via Twitter for iPad."
Oh shit!
pretty amusing. A bit of a faux pas. The cynical side of it is someone's paying her to say that she likes the Surface.
Yeah.
Obviously, someone in this case would be Microsoft. The less cynical side is that there's no Twitter client on. Well, there's no native Twitter client for Surface yet, so maybe she's still using her iPad for some things. I'm willing to believe the latter. She actually has, two devices and uses different ones for different things. It's not unlike, you know, many of us have, unlike I use an iPad sometimes and I have an Android phone for other times. Yeah. It would not be crazy for me to send a tweet from my, from an iPad saying that I liked my Android phone. I don't know, whatever. Haha, funny.
I think that she never operates her Twitter herself.
Well, that's not often, yes.
It's entirely possible that she's been carrying her Surface RT around with her from the first moment she saw the thing. But the reality is that the Surface RT is a piece of shit. it's garbage. The hardware is all right, but the software is half-baked and they shouldn't have released it yet because Windows RT is garbage. And the Surface Pro... it's going to be the device to really check and see if
the thing that blew my mind, I don't think I mentioned this on the show, the thing that blew my mind about the Surface when I found out, is, you know, the smallest Surface you can get is a 32 gig one, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think that's right.
So that's cool. It's got 32 gigs of storage for putting stuff on.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
It's got about 16 gigs of storage. Because the operating system and associated pre-installed apps are about 15, 16 gigs.
Oh, jeez.
It's insane. It's huge. So that'll be interesting when it sells here. I'll be interested to see if anyone does if anyone goes to the Commerce Commission about it.
One thing. Now, you know, we can make jokes about Microsoft all day because, I mean, lately they're an easy target. Windows 8 sales.
They've always been an easy target.
I don't know. Windows 7 was pretty great, and it sold like hotcakes.
Didn't make them any less of an easy target.
Windows Phone is Windows Phone is in shit. It is in strife. They've basically ruined Nokia, who had 30% of the market and is now down to like 2% of sales. Right? Windows Phone is it's toxic. I really hope it works, and people who use it, and I've used it a little bit, it's really nice. Windows Phone is really lovely. But I don't know. It just people don't seem to want to buy. If people try it, they might discover that they like it. And people who do use it think that it's great. And I may have mentioned this on the show before, but people who have used Windows Phone, when they see like an Android or an iPhone, they say to me, when I've spoken to them about it, because I talk about phones because I'm a troublemaker, they say Android and iPhone look old-fashioned now. And they're right.
I really do like the UI design of Windows Phone, although, God damn it, it gets fucked up quickly.
Yeah.
I've said this before, I think, on the show. The beautiful Windows Metro, which it isn't anymore, whatever, UI layout with the little tiles and things and the little monochromatic logos, that lasts for about 2 minutes until you install an app that has some fucking, like, 256-color icon that just doesn't sit nicely with tiles or the tile background color is different. Fuck.
Yeah.
Keith Patton from Market Metro tells us that Windows Phone has a 7% market share in New Zealand, which I find
that really hard to believe.
I find it questionable, unless perhaps there were a shitload of old Windows. Oh, it's Windows Mobile, isn't it? I wonder if that counts as the same thing. There were a lot of old Windows Mobile still floating around.
I'd be surprised if they still work. I actually had a Windows Mobile, whatever, 6 or something, and it was really good, actually, but all I used it for was as an ebook reader. The 920 seems lovely. It's very large. But the thing that I find the most lovely about it is the beautiful big bright colours. And a weird thing that's happening in New Zealand is we're getting a limited selection. Now, who was it? Someone posted on Twitter, it was Telecom or someone, saying,
vote for our next colour.
Tell us which one colour you want. And it's like, I wanted to see a red one and a yellow one and think about it. Anyway.
What one? Did you see which one they decided to go with?
I don't know. Hopefully it's the red one because the red one's great.
Yeah, they probably won't do the red one because it's a bit too Vodafone-y.
Although the size has probably put me off, frankly. I don't know. I'm probably going to get another Android.
I got another story.
Oh, boy!
Is
this going to be a really...
We love copyright, right?
I like nothing better than copyright.
A small committee in the US, a political study committee, came out with a document that isolated three myths about copyright and some issues with copyright law in the States.
Yeah.
And also suggested four primary areas for reform.
Yeah.
The study committee was a Republican study committee.
All right, so let me guess. First idea for reform was every song that you share, you get another whip of a cane and another year in jail.
Close. Other way.
With another year and you get an what?
So they wanted to. The four potential policy solutions were reforming statutory damages to make them less insane.
What?
Expanding fair use allowances.
What?
To implement punishment for false copyright claims.
What?
And to heavily limit the terms for copyright and create disincentives for renewal.
But this is so exciting. Those are really excellent ideas. I'm really excited to see what they do.
The three myths they isolated about copyright were that the purpose of copyright is to compensate the creator of the content, that copyright is free market capitalism at work, and that current copyright regime leads to the greatest innovation and productivity.
Wow, and those are all myths, they reckon.
Yeah.
Well, so, that's brilliant. So obviously the laws are going to change there, and hopefully that'll have a flow-on effect to here because John Key is completely in the pocket.
Unfortunately, the report has been retracted by the same committee that issued it.
What?
Yeah, after we presume the MPAA and RIAA, who are both very heavy lobbyists of the Republican Party in the US, got involved.
Lobby is another word for they give them money.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Very active money givers.
That is what we in the trade call corruption.
The MPAA is headed by a former, a very influential former US, I'm going to say, senator. Yeah. I can never remember if it's senator or congressman, Chris Dodd.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's that. So sanity prevailed briefly, but then stopped prevailing.
God damn it.
Still, the report's out there. You can read it if you want to. It's got some good details and stuff in it. I've skimmed it. I haven't read it properly because that would take too long and I don't have time.
This is the internet, Dylan. No one reads everything.
Although the author of the report also actually answered questions on Reddit. So you can also read the thread on Reddit about it.
Wow, hey. And said, and halfway through, did he disappear? And then someone
said, oh, BRB, just been called into boss's office.
And then suddenly it was all caps and the spelling changed. And
yeah, that's right. I was wrong about everything I have said. Yeah, I think that's pretty much how it went down.
Buy the new Britney Spears album.
Yeah, don't download it. We're watching you.
Or, I mean, whatever it is that, you know, is meant to be purchased by the kids today.
Shall I change tack and go towards a horrible, horrible story?
Let me ease the transition.
We've got a middle ground.
Because that's what I'm good at.
Very good at easing transitions.
Gay Labour, and this is another story about corruption, sort of. Gay Labour has lost its way, says convicted felon Philip Field.
Excuse me, former Labour Party MP.
Well, I was going to get to that. But the thing is...
I thought I was giving you an alternative headline for him.
Oh, okay. Well...
You want to go for convicted felon? There's no such thing as a felony in... Convicted.
Well, whatever. He was convicted of serious crimes, and we know it was serious because he was sentenced to 6 years in jail. 6 years! And he got out after three, right? And the charges were bribery and corruption and attempting to pervert the course of justice, right? So this guy is a dickhead. I mean, he's a bad dude. Now, you might say, hey, it was just about, you know, getting tiles put on his roof or whatever. But, you know, I don't think you go to jail just for getting tiles put on your roof. Not for 6 years.
No.
Anyway, and this is the last thing that Labour needs right now. But now, in the Stuff article here, he's described as a disgraced former MP. Yeah, disgraced.
No, that's definitely correct.
So actually, apparently he was only in jail for about 2 years because it's been a year since he got out, but he's been quiet since then. And he's compared himself with Nelson Mandela.
Well, that's a stretch.
He says the Labour Party has lost its way and been contaminated by liberal policy. It's a left party! They are liberal!
He means... socially liberal about gay.
What is this guy? Did he think that he was in the National Party or in Christian Heritage or something? Because
he wanted an economically left wing, socially Christian party. I'm not sure which one that would be.
Right.
Maybe Christian Heritage before the old.
Maybe New Zealand First.
Kitty humping. Maybe. Actually, yeah, probably.
What a dickhead! Unfortunately, he actually has quite a lot of support and the Polynesian community in Auckland.
I heard someone else say offline in the real world that he actually, what he's saying is actually quite representative of what a number of Polynesian people feel, as we remember from that protest about said things not that long ago with the crazy signs.
Yeah. Well, now here's the thing. All of us have our thinking affected by the things that we hear, the things that we are told. None of us is immune to that. And when... the most powerful political messages you get are when you're at church every Sunday, then you're going to get your mind is going to be infected with certain ideas. And, you know, let's not pretend that, you know, the Pacific community is not the biggest church going community. So it's natural. And I mean, you know, preachers pretty widely respected in religious communities. So when someone that you respect and that your family tells you was a great man tells you that, you know, the gays are the problem with everything and that they are like animals and that it's all unnatural, then you're probably going to believe it.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem.
Well, for what it's worth, they follow the same pattern, or the Pacific community tends to follow the same pattern that many
45 minutes.
That many other communities do, and that is that the younger generations are a lot more open and accepting.
Yeah.
So, you know, wherever that is at the moment, it will just get less and less.
It's weird that it's a problem actually with the Pacific communities, because where do Fafina come from, right?
It's a whole different thing. It's very complex. I don't understand it well enough to try and explain it, but there's a very weird relationship that has with the community and moral standards and religion.
Human sexuality being complicated, Dylan, I've never heard of such a thing.
Usually it's pretty straightforward, but that particular issue.
Yeah. Anyway,
it's not just about the gays.
This guy is, and actually, interesting, you mentioned the gays. The male gays is a very interesting subject. Anyway, so what was your story?
Well, goodness. So, in Ireland, abortion is illegal in all cases except where the mother's health is endangered, or life maybe even, not just health.
And now I'm going to guess that the reason for that is the same thing.
It's a Catholic country.
Exactly. It's the religion getting involved once again, just as with part of the
previous
story.
In fact, I saw
story.
An amazing snippet from Stephen Fry talking about religion in a thing called Intelligence Squared, I think, in the UK a couple of years ago. Anyway, about Catholics and about Catholics being ridiculously obsessed with sex, the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
But regardless of all that, an Indian woman in the UK named Savita, whose last name I'm not going to try and pronounce, was pregnant and presented at hospital at 17 weeks with basically miscarrying. She presented, saw a doctor and was miscarrying. The doctor basically told her that the baby couldn't survive. And would probably, you know, it would be over in a few hours.
Yeah.
She then spent 2.5 days in hospital repeatedly begging doctors to do something.
Yeah.
But as long as the baby had a heartbeat,
yeah,
they were told that she was told that the doctors couldn't do anything. Yeah. They wouldn't perform an abortion,
right,
even though that they'd determined that the baby had no chance of survival.
How far
so anyway,
is she?
2.5 days until 2.5 days she spent in agony until the fetal heartbeat stopped.
Yeah.
At which point the dead fetus was removed.
Yeah.
The unit, an intensive care unit, but she died of septicemia.
Right.
A week basically after she appeared at hospital.
Right. Which, I mean, I suppose it's possible that would have happened anyway, but it seems very unlikely if the doctors had been able to intervene when it became very clear that there was no chance for the fetus,
which was almost immediately, within hours of her arriving in hospital, they were clear that there was no chance for the fetus surviving.
Right. If she needed to get the hell out of that country, unfortunately, I imagine she was in terrible agony and needed to be in that hospital bed. But if she had been able to get across the channel, if she'd been able to get across the channel, they probably would have been able to do something and save her life. This is fucking religion getting involved where it should have no place. It should be a medical decision. It's not a moral question.
Yeah, and some commentary I've seen, people criticizing the doctors, saying that in fact they could have legally performed an abortion because her life was, you know, her life was threatened. The counter to that I've seen is that doctors tend not to want to because that's somewhat subjective.
Yeah.
And in doing so, they potentially open themselves up to prosecution on the grounds that some other doctor comes out and says, no, she wasn't. God just could have sorted it out on his own. So that's absurd. And there's a couple of investigations underway. I don't know how long that'll take, but she's dead. Her husband's distraught, obviously. And that's a shitty thing to happen in any apparently right-thinking country.
Yeah.
There you go. So that's a depressing story.
There are a lot of miscarriages around. They're always pretty terrible, and no one wants to hear about people dying when they absolutely and clearly and obviously don't need to. And for it to be for such terrible reason is just shameful. And I'm pleased that it wouldn't. It's very unlikely to happen here for that reason. That's, you know, we do a lot of things right here.
To be fair, New Zealand law is not much better, but the interpretation of law is.
Do you think it's difficult to get an abortion in New Zealand?
It's not, but the law as it stands, in theory, should make it more difficult.
The law is not exactly followed to the letter here, and that's pretty much the way it should be, probably.
Well, no, the way it should be is the law should be rewritten.
Well, that's true, of course. The law should always have
people operating on
technicalities,
understanding,
and so on.
Yeah. Sort of extension of the legal precedent, the legal.
Yeah.
Such situation should be resolved to actually match what people are doing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's true. I think that just abortion's pretty terrible.
I don't think anyone thinks it's a.
And I don't think that it should be encouraged, and I don't think it should be treated as contraception. It seems that some people do treat it as contraception.
I think. I find that very hard.
A very small number of people, but it does happen.
I think that's incredibly. An incredibly teeny number, and they do
the rest of women no favors because they make it more likely. Those terrible edge cases is what the nutters can use in the media when they say we need to tighten the law.
They do anyway. They don't even need the edge cases. They'll find other reasons.
Anyway, one of the solutions, according to the next story, it's almost like we've planned this, and this is at the suggestion of doctors, is to prescribe the morning after pill, aka emergency contraceptive pill,
ECP,
for teenagers before they need it. The nation's largest, and this is from NPR, so the nation they're talking about is the US, the nation's largest group of pediatricians is urging its members to write prescriptions in advance to enable teenagers to have fast access to the so-called morning after pill.
Yes. Is it? I don't know the answer to this. Is it by prescription here?
I actually don't know either. I think that you can just go to a pharmacy.
I think it may be a pharmacy. I'm pretty sure it's a pharmacist medication here.
But here's the thing. You can make your own.
It is available over the counter in New Zealand pharmacy.
You can make your own emergency contraceptive pill quite easily with most normal. Pills
with bleach and salt.
With ordinary contraceptive pills. But unfortunately, you need if a girl decides that she needs an ECP, then probably that means she doesn't have contraceptive pills. But it's actually quite easy. You can get directions on the internet. I saw it linked on Metafilter. You look in a matrix and you see. I've got this pill, and so I need to take four now, and then four in 12 hours, and it does this really basically the same job. But you're always much better off going and paying a few dollars, if you've had a condom breakage or whatever, and just going to the pharmacy, because the real thing has much fewer, less serious side effects than doing it the 8-pill way,
and also has a greater efficacy.
Yeah, it does. That's right. And the sooner you take it, the better, obviously. But it's important for people to get the message that morning after is absolutely not right. You can take it for like 4 days.
Yes.
Yeah. Not that you have any fucking clue about contraception, Dylan.
Apparently not.
Obviously, with all those children. I was actually just thinking today, I was looking at your wife's Twitter. You've got really good looking kids.
I know, isn't it weird?
It really is weird, and that's basically why I mention it. Because your kids
don't worry, they could still grow out of it.
Your kids are lovely.
Yeah. Yep. It's
The crazy one's actually lovely. Although only when it's sleeping.
All of them are a lot nicer when they're sleeping.
Your crazy kid reminds me so much of me.
I'm not entirely sure which one's my crazy one, but right.
Oh, really? So do you have an Urban Dictionary Word of the Week?
I actually do.
Oh,
Your Urban Dictionary Word of the Week is baby beer.
Urban Dictionary Word of the Week.
Baby beer or baby bear?
Beer. B-E-A-R. Bear. Bear.
Baby bear. I am going to guess that this is sort of like a twink, only fat and just starting to get hairy.
A small fat gay man.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. small, fat, hairy gay man. Yeah. No, it is not. It is a 1,482 upvotes.
Yeah.
2,314 downvotes.
Yeah.
It is when something is just right, not too hot, not too cold, not too big, not too small.
Oh.
As the example here is, are you hungry? Nah, man, I'm baby beer. I'm just right.
All right.
There you go.
Well, other things that are just... Oh, I should probably...
You're all wrong.
You're all wrong. You specifically, Morgan, are wrong. A thing that is right is telecom. And a lot of people have probably heard about this already. It's from a few days ago. Telecom have purchased givealittle.co.nz or acquired somehow, which is an online charitable site where charitable organizations and individuals can fundraise. And yeah. Some people were probably like, huh, what are they doing with that? Well, what they're doing with that is making it absolutely zero fees. So previously there was an administration charge. And of course, when you donated using a credit card, there was, the percentage fees that you pay there. And now there's going to be zero fees for running a campaign on it. And it looks like Telecom, maybe they've negotiated with the credit card companies, I don't know. They are covering the cost of the credit card fees as well, which is amazing.
There you go.
It's absolutely brilliant.
I've said it before, and I will say it again.
Yep.
Telecom are not dicks.
No, that's right. They're not dicks.
I think they've been increasingly less dickish in the last few years.
Since they've realized that is actually a market advantage.
Yes, and also I think separating from Chorus, where they stopped having that weird conflict of interest internally, has helped a lot.
Yeah. Do you know, and I used to think of them as terrible dicks, and now I actually think of them quite warmly. Even though I don't currently have any services with them, I actually think of them quite warmly now. You know who I don't think very warmly of, and that's TVNZ. Every time I think that I couldn't have a lower opinion of them, something else happens. They join a joint venture with their biggest competitor as a minority partner, for instance. Which they are doing with Igloo, or they scrap New Zealand's only decent TV channel, which was TVNZ7, and it's in light of that actually the latest thing has happened. They did Television New Zealand did a survey and a bunch of research in advance of axing it. And they found that the audience was growing and awareness was growing hugely and the number of viewers was up massively, and they hid that. They hid that fact because it wasn't expedient, because they wanted to kill the channel.
Well, yes and no. I still, the thing I still have is I'm not willing to blame TVNZ for the end of the channel. They were simply defunded. They were running the channel as a public service channel. They're not in a position to be able to fund it themselves. And the government, specifically the national government, chose specifically to not fund it.
Of course, there is. We've spoken about this before, and I guess people can go back and listen to whatever the hell show that was in. And we have always disagreed on this a little bit, and we don't need to continue to argue about it like a pair of bickering old married couple.
Sure.
I think that you are correct that there was that it needed to be funded by the government. Because public broadcasting does tend to be. To say that TVNZ had no options, obviously, is also not correct.
I don't think it is incorrect.
You think that they had no other options?
What other option do you think they did have?
There are other models available to them. For instance, and I don't know how much money they would make, but NPR does the pledge drive. They have a week where they get people to donate. And who knows how much they could have made from that. Also, I think that just running some advertising wouldn't have been a problem.
1 minute.
It would have been very hard, I think, to cover the cost of running the channel with advertising, given the small nature of it and the difficulty in measuring the viewership.
But it was certainly growing. And they did measure viewership, and it was growing.
The mandate
hugely.
Under which the channel was established didn't allow
they had five. There were 500,000 people watching at least once a week.
Yeah.
Right? That is very different from some of the excuses National used when they said that they weren't going to fund it and they didn't mind seeing it go
away. No, I agree. I think National's position on it was completely wrong. I don't, but I still don't think TVNZ was in a position to save it by themselves.
I think that they didn't want to save it because their board is a bunch of dickheads, and I think that they had plenty of. That, I mean, they're huge, they're a big media organization. Of course, they could have found a way to save it. It's not actually that expensive. Anyway,
three.
It's been great having you on the show. It was a bit bickery this week.
Two.
Yeah, it's because you're wrong.
That's probably right. I love you so much. I'll see you next week. Goodbye.
You're listening to the weekly show on sorry. With course.
We're using that one.
I might, you know, I am frequently wrong about things, but it would be less interesting if we just agreed on everything, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, probably.
Although it didn't seem to be argument so much as contradict.
I guess so.
This week. We needed a third voice.
No, because it'd be harder. More people to talk to. Don't want to. So confusing. Mm. Yeah, the problem that TVNZ, the position that TVNZ was in, though, that they don't have discretion to not return profit.
A dividend.
Yes, well, they have to return, essentially, yes. They have to make a profit and return a certain dividend to the government. I don't think they had, I don't think they could have funded it operationally. There may have been other funding mechanisms to explore, but I don't think those things were. I don't think there was time, unfortunately.
Of course there was time.
I don't know. $16 million a year was what they estimated to run it, and that was actually probably lowballing it slightly.
Yeah, that was the Save TVNZ 7 people who estimated that. It wasn't TVNZ, I think, was it?
No.
That figure. So who knows? But I mean, the thing is that as you has proven, you don't actually need a lot of money to make a show.
No, you don't. But it wasn't the making the show. It was the employing the people and the running the show and the services and the things like that. I mean, you look at Choice TV as another example, who've, you know, come up afterwards and offering some pretty interesting programming. They certainly do it for less money.
Yeah.
But they do a very different kind of thing, and they don't have the money to kind of fund the shows that. Well, they're not a public service broadcaster. You know, they have to run advertising and all these other things, but. Yeah, there is scope. I don't think the way TVNZ was originally established was quite right, and thus sort of always meant that there was going to be some big problem at the end.
Yeah. There are ways in which New Zealand is an outlier, and one of them is in not having a public broadcaster.
I don't think we should. I think we should have a public broadcaster. I think it should not be TVNZ. I think it maybe should still utilise the services of TVNZ, but not be TVNZ.
Yeah. It was TVNZ, of course. But you're right. I just don't think they're up to the job anymore. Now, here's the thing. I have reason.
Well, they weren't even when it was established. That's the problem. It was kind of wishful thinking on Labour's part that they could sort of.
Oh, I don't mean TVNZ 7. I mean TVNZ.
No, but TVNZ wasn't the right. You know, when TVNZ 7 was established, TVNZ still wasn't the right.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't an organisation that could run it. It was still at a weird sort of disparity between what TVNZ as an organisation was and what TVNZ 7 as a channel was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I think that was always set for conflict, unfortunately.
When you look at some of the content producers online, things like 5x5 and This Week in Tech and Revision 3, who obviously do a lot of video stuff, their cost per hour must be pretty low in terms of production. 5x5 obviously is just guys talking to a microphone. It's just a podcast.
Yeah,
this Week in Tech does video stuff as well, though. They do sort of panel shows. They do that kind of conversation stuff. Now, it's tech specific, but it could be about politics. It could be about whatever. You know, sending out a small crew of people with a bunch of inexpensive cameras. Now, I'm not going to pretend that there's no cost. I'm just saying that it's possible to make TV without spending a huge amount of money on it.
Well, it's possible to make content without spending a huge amount of money on it. It's very difficult to run a broadcast television channel without spending a lot of money on it.
Except if you have only one pipe to feed it into, or maybe two. If you're just feeding it into Freeview, right, which is sort of an imaginary thing. You know, if you're feeding it into this, I mean, so get a fucking warehouse somewhere in the city and run your line to TVNZ and then just, I don't know, lease.
Yeah, the problem is fucking... the money you're talking about, just even for the line to TVNZ, for the fees that Freeview charge to, you know, to put a
Which
channel up, it's not
really
free.
High. No, it's really high. It's really high.
So, I mean, you know, that alone, you know, certainly making the content can be quite cheap. If you look at Media 3, have you been to Media 3?
I have not been to Media 3.
Right.
I have watched it and I find it not as polished as Media 7 was.
No, it is not. And they're doing it on a lot less money and they're doing it in a much more, what would you say?
Shoestring?
Yeah, I guess I was going to say guerrilla kind of way.
Yeah.
You know, they're still using the sensibilities that they had for the original Media 7 show, but they're doing it, you know, they've chosen kind of the cheaper ways to do the things, and that's fine, and it works. I think they get very good value out of it, but it's still not inexpensive.
Yeah,
still, you know, tens of thousands of dollars per episode.
The thing is, I'm not sure that tens of thousands of dollars per episode is, I mean, for individual people, when you're thinking about your mortgage or your rent and the supermarket bill, it seems like a lot of money. But to many companies, tens of thousands of dollars is not a hell of a lot of money.
No, no, it's not. It's absolutely not.
When I look at some of our projects, they're millions of dollars. And,
yep.
And I think that if you set things up right, and we're really going over territory we've done before, if you set things up right, you can make programming for a lower cost than traditional broadcasters do. And in evidence of that, I would suggest that TVNZ adopting some of those techniques probably is proof. You know, the cheaper cameras.
Yeah, look.
Smaller crews, you know, not sending out a big truck when just a guy and, you know, two or three guys in a car is sufficient.
Well, that's, I mean, that, those things are all what happens. But there's a lot of, yeah.
The anyway, editing stuff
that's why,
seems
that's why TVNZ
easier.
Wasn't the right organization to do it, because TVNZ that's has right. that operational overhead already.
It's got a great big building and a whole lot of people. And let me say,
It can't be small. It doesn't have internally, institutionally, it doesn't have the familiarity with that kind of operating method. Mm. ULive does quite well though, interestingly enough. TVNZU,
yeah,
they've kind of figured it, but they just kind of left on their own to do it. And they just do it.
They've got three cameras, two of them on tripods and one on a little what are those little funny mounts, the little octopus leg things? I can't remember what they're called.
Gorilla. Pod thing.
Yeah, Gorilla Pod, yeah.
Yep.
That feeds into a Facebook app, and they've got a, what's it called, a TriCaster? And the producer is also on Camera Talent. And they just sit in the atrium, and they make, you know, actually quite entertaining stuff. But, I mean, it's obviously it's a very limited kind of television. But look at, you know, someone who was previously broadcasting on Freeview, Stratos, a.k.a. Triangle Television, not necessarily the greatest example of high-quality programming, but they were doing it. They couldn't get funding. I think they needed, like, a couple of million dollars more to be able to continue doing it. But they had a very small budget to begin with. And if they were able to almost do it, you know, just with a little bit of support and maybe some more creative people.
Absolutely not saying it can't be done.
I agree with you. I think TVNZ
could continue to live.
TVNZ's not the guys to do it anymore. They should have been the guys to do it, but things have changed. And one thing I want to say is that everyone who I've ever met from TVNZ was really cool. They were really onto it. They were really passionate about their job. They really loved what they were doing. And many of them are doing really cool things, but there's just something about the organization. I think it's the board. I think it's the senior leadership that they're just fuckheads. Those people at the top are fuckheads, and that prevents the organization from being as cool as it could be.
Well, I don't even think it's that necessarily. I just think it's that there's a lot of momentum with a business like that.
Yeah.
And it's very hard, first of all, to recognize opportunities for change, and even harder to actually take them up. Yeah. And I think when the board looks at something like TVNZ7 and says,
this is making no money.
Well, this is we have to, you know, we can't put ads on this. We can't monetize this. We need, you know, this is what it costs us to run it. We need this amount of money to make it run. The government's not going to give it to us. You know, we have no other option. It can't happen.
How much is TV One Plus One making them?
Oh, fuck all, but it doesn't cost them anything to run.
No, it doesn't.
probably, and it, you know, it's benefit. Like, a lot of people get added benefit from it. It probably does. I don't know how they measure the I don't know how they measure the viewership, but I do imagine it actually increases their ratings.
Yeah,
because I end up watching quite a lot of stuff on TVNZ Plus One and TV3 Plus One.
I actually do as well. I was very critical of it, and I use it all the time because I'll just catch the end of a show and I'll just be like, "Well, I've got a solution for that." Click.
Yeah.
I wish there was one for. I think TV2 doesn't have one. Is it TV2 that doesn't have one?
TV2 doesn't, and TV4 doesn't.
Right. And I wish TV2 had one. Ah!
Yeah, TVNZ had basically the transponder space or whatever it was, like, I guess, necessary to the channel space necessary to do one of them.
Yeah, I feel like
they chose TV1, and I thought that was the one they'd get more benefit from.
Yeah.
No, probably right. Although it's interesting because TV2 has higher ad revenue.
Yeah.
Or hot, yeah. Anyway.
It's unfortunate that that's so important, but, you know, obviously it has to be. Cause,
well, maybe that's why, though. If TV2 has high viewership, then
they don't want to split it.
Putting one on the Plus One gives more of a chance for people who are watching something on TV2 to watch something on TV1.
Yeah. Now, two very interesting points from the chat room. Eddie Caudry says good is very subjective, obviously. That's completely true.
Yeah, and it's always the problem I had with the public service television discussion where people saying, you know, people poo-poo...
And you're wrong.
Reality TV and poo-poo, you know, just, you know, sitcoms or anything else as bad television. They're not bad. And, you know, people enjoy watching television. For most people, is a entertainment.
Okay, but here's the thing, Dylan. Those people are catered to.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with catering to them.
I'm not suggesting that there is a problem with that. I'm not saying that we should have one channel.
No, but there are a lot of people who suggest that. That stuff is bad, is wrong.
It is bad.
Okay, well, I disagree.
Maybe if you let me finish, you might not disagree so readily.
I will.
It is bad, and it possibly should be done away with, and I really enjoy watching some of it.
Yeah, I still disagree with you.
Survivor is, I think, probably cost a great deal to produce, and most people now would probably say it wasn't reality television, but once upon a time, it was probably considered the first reality show. Once upon a time, back in the distant past.
Well, not really good anyway. The first reality show.
Unscripted.
The first reality show, as we understand it, was pretty much, what's it called? Not Road Rules. Show with a whole lot of people living in a house somewhere. Yeah. American show. Get back to you. Yeah. No, not Big Brother.
And in Survivor, there's a whole lot of people that live together on an island.
The real life. Right. No, the real world. That was the first reality show. Survivor, actually, Treasure Island in New Zealand was before Survivor.
Right, and it was so good. I liked that they didn't vote, but I've been enjoying the current season with the voting because it has been so amazing, no spoilers, but oh my God. The last two or three episodes, oh my God.
Yeah.
Seriously, it's so good. But the thing is that, you know, different people, that's commercial television, okay? It's some of it. Survivor, notwithstanding, is quite inexpensive to make. You get quite a big audience because it's, you know, you don't need to be particularly clever and you don't have to have a PhD to be able to follow it. All right. So it's going to have a big audience. It's commercial TV. That means it can be commercially successful. Okay. You get enough people that if you put ads in it, it will pay for itself. It will more than pay for itself. What does more than pay for itself mean? It means you get more back than you need to keep making it. So everyone gets to buy a private jet. Everyone gets to buy a peerage, maybe from Sealand, perhaps. And then perhaps you can use a little bit of that extra money to make other kinds of program. And some of that other stuff will be maybe slightly more risky stuff in a similar vein. But some of it might be more complicated stuff that perhaps, maybe you don't need a PhD, but perhaps maybe you'll need a BA.
So you mean that the only real world example I can think of this is Discovery, the Discovery Networks.
Yeah.
Where they make shows like The Deadliest Catch, which, you know, is really just an observational reality show.
Yeah.
Quite commercially successful.
Mm.
And they make Mythbusters.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, just a
it's pap.
Entertainment show.
It misleads people about what science is.
But they also make and fund documentaries, and they have Animal Planet, which has a lot of documentaries on it.
Yeah.
And they have other, you know, Discovery, and Discovery has stretches quite a long way. But for the most part, that doesn't happen. The problem is that, such as life, that things cost money to make, and the money has to come from somewhere.
And where it usually comes from with public broadcasters is the taxpayer.
Yeah, quite reasonably.
And we don't do that in New Zealand.
No, we should. We don't.
Well, I mean, of course, we actually sort of do, because we do have New Zealand on air. But what we don't have is a funded broadcaster.
My suggestion.
And every country that we ever compare ourselves to has got a funded broadcaster.
Do you want my suggestion for funding?
Yep.
We levy commercial television broadcasters.
Okay.
At the moment, they essentially get a license for almost nothing
yep.
to broadcast.
Yeah.
And they get to keep all the profit.
Yeah.
Even though one of the largest broadcasters is owned by the government, returns some of that profit to the government, thus the taxpayer, it doesn't matter. They still, you know, profit.
Yeah.
All of those entities, Sky Television included,
yeah.
Should pay a higher fee for the privilege of taking money off us.
I really like your idea.
And that, well, it's not just my idea. Guess whose policy it is?
Green.
I found this out after I thought of it myself.
It's green. Yes, yeah.
Green policy is similar.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Another thing would be, and this is only for Sky specifically, must carry, must pay.
Yes, must carry. Not sure about must pay.
I think must carry, must pay. It's how you pay for it. It's how you pay for
I think must carry. I think it can be funded another way because we don't have to do. Yeah, they must carry because it would be, you know, Sky Television is now. With the analog television is one of the methods of is one of the basic platforms for television.
Yeah.
So they must carry. I don't think they should have to pay because ideally it would be funded another way.
And it would be a requirement for all broadcasts, all platforms. So Freeview would have to carry. And,
obviously.
And that shouldn't be an issue. And Sky would have to carry, and that would mean that everyone would be able to see it. I really like that idea. That's a great idea. Who is the Greens broadcasting spokesperson?
Pass.
I wonder if people want to hear us talk about this anymore. God, probably not. I find it really fascinating because I think that TV is brilliant.
So I'm one of the reasons I'm fascinated by this stuff is the simplistic view that a lot of people have on television is that television will die because we have the internet now.
Yeah.
I think that's.
You know what I use the internet for? I use it for watching TV.
Yeah. Someone has to fund that programming.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it has to be supported somehow.
Yeah.
And more than that is that, I don't know if you do it anymore, but you know, once upon a time you used to go into a video store. You'd like, I want to watch a movie tonight. You walk into a video store. And then what happens?
And you'd get a cassette. You browse around. You look at these things. You say.
You just stand there looking at everything, knowing, having no freaking idea what the hell you want to watch.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
I wish there were reviews on these things.
Well, that's all well and good, but television becomes the problem is eliminated with television because someone programs it for us. We know if we look at, you know, whatever channel, we will find a certain type of programming, and we can choose to watch that or not. We don't really, you know, no one has to deal with it for us. Someone else finds it for us, curates it, and blasts it at our eyeballs.
Yeah,
that's what's largely lacking in internet. Television alternatives.
Yeah.
It's a boat. Sorry. 3-year-old drew a picture of a boat. It looks like a boat. 4-year-old drew a picture of a boat. It looks like a boat.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got a story about boating. I think it was near Dunedin, but not in Dunedin. Deborah Bay. That's where it was. I don't know where that is. Tyree Mouth. Don't know where that is either. Somewhere near Otago, but not on land, at sea. A bumbling boaty slated by emergency services.
This is one of your news stories. We're not allowed to do that. We're just talking shit at the moment.
Says he could easily... Now, this is the thing. All right, I'm going to tell you what happened before I tell you the other part.
Yeah.
He purchased a boat, and he didn't know how to operate it.
Yeah.
And he got into a little bit of trouble. He ran aground... at Punawia in the Catlins. But he managed to get afloat, apparently. So that was all right. And so then he decided to seek shelter at Tyree Mouth. And he came around an island. And then the engine room caught on fire. You know, it, I'm sure it happens. It, this is a 10-meter boat. I guess... so then he runs aground again. And now he's, this time he doesn't manage to get afloat again. So he sets off a flare, but he didn't fire it up. He fired it horizontally. And almost hit a house. And so then... he had a second flare, so obviously he was doing something right. But instead of firing that off, he set it off inside the boat. And there's a quote from him. I was trying to attract attention and I wasn't getting any. The next minute, there were police cars and fire engines and ambulances turning up. Unfortunately, he couldn't find the right channel on his radio to contact them. And the battery on his phone ran out. And so now in the dark, with his boat being smashed by the waves, still run aground, he was finally rescued by some surf lifesavers in a little inflatable. Now here's the thing. He's decided he wants to buy a microlite.
Excellent plan.
Which is going to go so well. He's going to die. I mean, we're all going to die. Anyway, I love that story so much just because everything is wrong. Everything is wrong. I have had my own boating failures in the past. I went sailing with a friend on his, I don't even know what size it was. It was a little one. Not a trailer sailor, but a little one. And we went out and around the Gulf and it was really great fun. And then on the way back, all three of us, and it was so much fun being kind of that few people, three people on a yacht. Everyone has to kind of be working all the time just to make the thing go where you want it to go, and it's brilliant being really involved. Although I did have a go on the, is it a tiller? What's the thing that makes it steer? Anyway, on the rudder, what's the bit you hold in your hand though? No jokes, you tiller, I think it's something like that. And I was a bit rubbish with that.
A few years ago, I can't even remember what it must have been about 2003. I actually went to Mission Bay and just hired one of those little catamarans just by myself.
What was it like? Was it hard?
No, I mean, I surprisingly knew how to sail.
Right.
No, I'm not brilliant, but I remembered enough from learning little bits of sailing to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And thinking back on it now, I was like, man, that was quite a bold move on my part.
Yeah. We were good at the sailing and we were very bad at the dinghying because we sank the dinghy on the way back from where the boat was moored.
It doesn't get much worse at dinghying than that.
No, it was pretty bad. It's not my fault. It wasn't my fucking dinghy. Apparently, it turns out after the fact that it was meant to have an inflatable ring around it and they were using it without the inflatable ring.
Ah, yeah, that makes a really big difference.
So it was basically just the rigid hull.
Not surprised.
And we're traveling back. I don't remember why I wasn't too worried about it on the way out to the boat. Maybe, I don't remember why. But on the way back, and I was like, man, we seem to be really low in the water. And then suddenly, well, you couldn't get much lower than under it. And that's how I killed my first cell phone. Brilliant. Might be dangerous to take a phone out on the water.
Well, it shouldn't maybe be. But yeah, you can get little plastic bags to stop that happening.
It didn't seem necessary. Man, it was a long way to swim, you know. Boats make a big difference to... in the boat it was like, oh, it's just from here to there. But when you're in the water, everything seems much much more dangerous. Much more dangerous. I want to talk... Man, I should have
done
the Jetstar story sooner. Yep.
We need to end this, but I just need to... I've just got a contact request on Skype.
Yeah.
From Clement Ebot. Who's Western Union Ghana Limited, number 42.
Yeah.
Dear beneficiary, do reconfirm your information as your grant funds will be transferred via Western Union money transfer only in accordance with the engagement agreement of the various ministries involved, which we are clearly warned not to tamper with your funds and no deduction for whatever reason, stating it as a measure of blah, blah, blah. Oh, my goodness.
Do you think we can talk to them without you having to add them into your system and give them your information?
Absolutely not. No. I am now going to block this person.
Oh, that's too bad. Because that might have been fun.
Also report abuse. Excellent. That's that done.
That's no fun.
All right. I call Enzies.
Fish and chips. Fish and chips.
Sorry, the show is cancelled. Beep.